Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Claire McDonnell, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 2nd of October, these are our main stories. The US Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, has refused to allow five current and former State Department employees to cooperate this week with the impeachment inquiry into President Trump. Armed Peruvian police are stopping MPs from entering Congress after the president dissolved the chamber, triggering a constitutional crisis. Scientists have worked out the total amount of carbon on Earth, which they say has far-reaching implications for the future of the planet. Also in this podcast...
Because so many Russians cannot afford legal spirits, they've started making their own alcohol.
Despite this, new figures show a marked improvement in the life expectancy of Russians, a trend attributed to a sharp reduction in alcohol consumption, particularly amongst men. The US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has refused to allow five State Department officials to appear for questioning by a congressional committee in the coming week. He accused the committee of trying to intimidate and bully his employees. Well, as part of their impeachment inquiry into President Trump, Democrats in the House of Representatives wanted the officials, including the former US ambassador to Ukraine, Mary Yovanovitch, and the president's special envoy to the country, Kurt Volker, to make depositions this week. Mr. Pompeo said that was not feasible. The committee is looking into claims that Mr. Trump asked the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to find incriminating information on his rival Joe Biden. I spoke to our Washington reporter Tara McKelvey and asked her what reasons Mike Pompeo is giving for not allowing the officials to cooperate with the congressional committee at this time.
Mr. Pompeo says that at this point in time that the lawmakers have issued this request in a way that's not proper. Mr. Pompeo said that they did not give a notice of deposition. He also said that these lawmakers did not give enough time for them to testify and that these officials needed to have lawyers present. Mr. Pompeo also used a political argument. He said that the lawmakers were engaged in an act of intimidation. And in this way, Mr. Pompeo was reflecting the larger argument of President Trump. He's very much cast himself as a victim in this drama. And Mr. Pompeo is doing the same in casting these lawmakers as bullies.
So he says they're not ready, so they may give evidence at some point. But what actions, on the flip side, can the committee take to force cooperation here?
The lawmakers say, first of all, they have followed the rules. And secondly, if these officials do not appear before the go to Capitol Hill, as they've been instructed, that they'll be guilty of obstruction of justice. These lawmakers can also put political pressure on Mr. Pompeo and on the officials themselves. And finally, there's an option that's known as inherent contempt, which could mean that the lawmakers, that these officials who do not abide by these requests could be fined or even put in jail. That's not very likely, but that's something that is an option.
Tara McKelvey there. Hong Kong police have said that an officer who shot an 18-year-old protester was protecting the lives of himself and his colleagues. The teenager was wounded during some of the worst violence in 4 months of pro-democracy protests. More than 50 people have been hospitalised. The police fired tear gas and water cannons. The protesters set fires, attacked officers and damaged public buildings. The Hong Kong police commissioner, Stephen Lo Wang Chung, defended his officers.
Our officers are doing their job wholeheartedly, every day, committing themselves to protect the city and protect the life and property of the Hong Kong citizen. We are in a difficult moment, but we will remain steadfast.
Tuesday's unrest was in stark contrast to celebrations in Beijing, where there was a major parade to mark 7 decades of Communist Party rule in China. So, how were events in Hong Kong seen in Beijing and in Hong Kong itself? James Kumarasamy spoke to Emily Lau, a former chair of the Democratic Party of Hong Kong, who served on the Legislative Council for 18 years, and also Victor Gao, director of the China National Association of International Studies and a former Chinese diplomat and government advisor. First, Emily Lau, was she surprised by the level of violence in Hong Kong on Tuesday?
Well, I am horrified. But of course, for days, there have been all these rumours, reports circulating that big things are going to happen to coincide with the celebrations in Beijing. And of course, there are people here who may want to embarrass, if not humiliate, President Xi Jinping on this important day, because Hong Kong people are very angry. Many of us are, and we feel there is not much to celebrate. So that's why we've seen this. And it is terrible. And President Xi Jinping and Carrie Lam, they have to do something quickly to bring this to an end, to try to de-escalate.
Victor Gao, how does it look from Beijing?
It is very obvious that the situation in Hong Kong is getting more and more dangerous, characterized by violence and anarchy and attack on police and arson, throwing of petrol bomb, etc. This is really no longer, by any measurement, peaceful demonstration or lawful protests. This is criminality, this is violence, and this is disruption of law and order in Hong Kong. I think anyone with the decency of the mind should condemn such violence. Now, Hong Kong police is very overstretched right now. They are doing their job. Their job is to maintain law and order in Hong Kong for the benefit of all the people in Hong Kong. And I hope the Hong Kong police, the Hong Kong SAR government, will do their job and step up to all these challenges. No one should expect that such violence can go on forever, or such violence can go on without impunity.
To what extent has this overshadowed the celebrations in Beijing?
Definitely. The situation which happened in Hong Kong is very regrettable and very traumatic. However, if you look at the celebration, I think it's a perfect celebration. The whole Chinese nation throughout the country are celebrating the National Day, the 70th anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic of China. I don't think any storm in the teacup in Hong Kong can take any dent out of the euphoria and the optimism of the Chinese nation celebrating the 70th year anniversary.
Emily Lau, a storm in a teacup. How do you see it?
Well, maybe in his teacup in Beijing, it is a big deal to the many Hong Kong people and to many people in the international community. If it is just a storm in a teacup, we would not have had wall-to-wall coverage in the international news media.
Emily Lau, former member of the Legislative Council of Hong Kong. Armed police in Peru are preventing MPs from entering Congress a day after the president dissolved the chamber, whilst a group of about 20 parliamentarians are refusing to leave, Warren Bull reports.
Streets around Parliament in Lima are in lockdown following the decision of President Martin Vizcarra on Monday to close Parliament, something that last happened in Peru in 1992, when the currently jailed Alberto Fujimori introduced a state of emergency. Mr. Vizcarra said the opposition-backed chamber was blocking his anti-corruption reforms and ordered new elections in January. The opposition says the dissolution amounts to a coup d'etat and has suspended Mr. Vizcarra, setting up a rival head of state, his vice president Mercedes Araoz. The armed forces have pledged loyalty to the president, and many Peruvians support his move, arguing that the parliament is corrupt.
Warren Bull. Scientists say they've worked out the total amount of carbon on Earth, a discovery which could have implications for everything from understanding where life can exist to forecasting volcanic eruptions. The study was carried out by an international team and took 10 years to complete. Our science correspondent Jonathan Amos has been to Cambridge University in eastern England to find out more.
Carbon is the fundamental chemical element necessary for life, and it's also right at the heart of the climate challenge. For these reasons, the Deep Carbon Observatory project has sought to catalogue where the element exists and how it moves around the planet, measuring gases from volcanoes and sifting muds on the ocean floor. One finding is a number for all of the carbon on Earth, 1.85 billion billion tonnes, the vast majority of it held beneath the surface. Another outcome has been to track the stability of carbon through time, such as its storage in limestone rocks. Only on rare occasions in the last billion years have there been major disturbances when carbon dioxide has been released into the atmosphere in large measure. And it looks like we're going through one of them now, says Professor Marie Edmonds from Cambridge University.
10 years of human-produced CO2 emissions is roughly equivalent to perhaps an asteroid impact or a sequence of these very large volcanic eruptions. And left to its own devices, the planet will draw that CO2 down, but it will take a long time, of the order of 100,000 years.
The research underlines the scale of our climate problem, but there's some good news. In measuring the CO2 coming from Earth's volcanoes, scientists can see that large surges herald eruptions. This could become a new form of forecasting.
That report from Jonathan Amos in Cambridge. Madagascar is one of the leading producers of vanilla, but this booming industry has seen a growing population of prisoners held for its theft. Under Malagasy law, adults can be imprisoned for up to 5.5 years without trial, and children up to 33 months for serious crimes. Vanilla theft is tried as a special crime, which means those accused of it are more likely than not to spend a long period in prison before trial. The lengthy pre-detention laws, coupled with poor conditions for child prisoners who are in adult prisons, have been described as unlawful and inhumane. In a special report, Pumza Falani reports now from Madagascar.
Eri is a 16-year-old boy who's already spent 3 years of his childhood in prison.
Here is where we store water for showering and washing clothes. And here is the place for cooking.
He's showing us around a prison block he shares with 181 boys aged between 13 and 17. We're in Antalaha prison, one of the largest detention centres in the Sava region. We're not using his real name to protect his identity.
Here is the bedroom. It is not that big, it gets cramped. Sometimes we sleep on our sides, sometimes laying flat. Sometimes we are sitting. Here we take a shower if it's at night while we're locked in. And here is our toilet. All of it is a place to sleep, a place to sit, and a place to eat.
Small room. They're absolutely crammed and are sleeping on hard concrete. There's barely any room to move. A few thin mattresses, but for everybody else, it's just the hard floor. And it smells really bad. It's absolutely dirty. Like Eri, the majority in this prison are accused of stealing vanilla. He's been sentenced to 5 years in jail, but he maintains he's innocent.
The life here is very difficult, very hard, because you are under someone else's control. Life is very difficult, especially when you don't have someone looking after you, someone to bring you food and someone to support you when you're not well.
There's a large crowd crouching in the courtyard. Many of them are thin. Their legs, their arms, their faces, their clothes are torn. It's a small space for a very large group. It's easy to get sick in here. I'm just looking around. A few of them have spots on their legs, some what looks like a rash. And the doctors have said it could be measles. And quite a few are coughing. I've also been told that a number of them have tuberculosis. We speak to the head of the prison, Volaraza Mohammadi.
It is overcrowded. The maximum number of inmates should be 285, but our numbers have reached 2,302, which goes way above international standards. But there's nothing we can do. This is the infrastructure we have. We have to live with it.
Madagascar's laws on pretrial detention mean children can be imprisoned for months, even years, before they see the inside of a courtroom to plead their case. And when they finally do, it is often without a lawyer. Vanilla trade is big business in Madagascar. A kilogram can sell for at least $150 in the export market. The authorities have taken a tough stance on its theft. It's now considered a serious crime. The Justice Ministry says it is trying to improve the conditions but doesn't have the resources. Its chief of staff, Rava Savatara, explains.
In Madagascar, crimes involving vanilla are actually considered as major crimes because we must protect the vanilla grower, the consumer, but above all, the flow of trade.
The laws here say they are innocent until they're proven guilty. So if they have not had a trial, why are they forced to live in those conditions? Why are they in prison in the first place?
Yes, indeed. The law says that someone is presumed innocent until proven guilty by the justice system. But the law also says that we can put those who have committed the crime temporarily in prison to protect society.
We showed the conditions of the prison to a human rights lawyer, Haratselavo Rakotsason, who believes vanilla theft should be treated as a petty crime.
To protect vanilla, we kind of sacrifice the Malagasy and the children, you know, but they don't care. It's not ethical, it's not legal, and most of all, I think we sense here that the priority of this land is much more on vanilla than on human beings. So that's the sad thing, you know.
Back in Antalaha, the boys are getting on a canoe as part of a new project by advocacy group, the International Labour Organization. It started in March. About once a month, they are taken to a vanilla plantation where they learn to plant and care for vanilla. The aim is to help prepare them for a life when they leave prison. The planting they are doing is on state land. But for Eri, this time is a momentary escape from a congested prison.
I'm happy to be able to see this view, green trees all around, and feel this breeze, and breathe in fresh air, instead of being behind prison walls.
As they return to the prison, they sing, "When night falls, I miss my father and mother, but my life belongs to someone else now. I may be far from you, but I'm not dead yet. I will be home someday."
That report by Pumza Falani in Madagascar. Now news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
I'm Kim Chakanetsa, and I'm the host of The Conversation podcast from the BBC World Service.
Oh boy, I'm overwhelmed with so much to say in such a short time.
Some recent favourites include an episode on female roadies, these two incredible women who've just been touring the world of musicians and had some incredible stories to tell.
This is a live show and sometimes things go wrong, and tonight something's gone wrong.
I also found the episode on women living with schizophrenia incredibly powerful.
She does not believe that there's such a thing as a mental illness. She still thinks that perhaps it was a demonic possession that happened to me.
Another episode was about women who were standing up to street harassment.
I'm sick of it. It's in front of my house. It's in my street. It's near my train station. It's all the time.
And I've always had female flight attendants on my wish list, and we finally got to speak to two women who had spent a lot of time up there.
People just stormed the door because they had to get off the plane. They were so scared.
That's The Conversation from the BBC World Service.
Can't put price tag on these emotions.
Search for The Conversation wherever you found this podcast.
The Duchess of Sussex has begun legal action against The Mail on Sunday, a newspaper here in the UK, over a claim it unlawfully published one of her private letters. In a statement, Prince Harry referred to what he called relentless propaganda against his wife Meghan and said he wasn't prepared to see her victimised by the press as his late mother Princess Diana was. The Duke and Duchess are on the last leg of their tour of Southern Africa. Our royal correspondent Nicholas Witchell is in Johannesburg and has more details about the very strongly worded statement by Prince Harry.
It is remarkably outspoken. It is nothing less than a stinging attack on the British tabloid media. Now, at the centre of this legal case is a letter written by the Duchess to her estranged father Thomas at his home in Mexico, portions of which were quoted in the Mail on Sunday earlier this year. In his statement, the Duke says that his wife has become one of the latest victims of the British tabloid media. He refers to a ruthless campaign that's escalated over the past year. He talks about the double standards of this specific press pack, which has vilified her almost daily for the past 9 months. He says that this amounts to bullying. And then he says this: "My greatest fear is of history repeating itself." I have seen what happens when someone I love is commoditized to the point where they are no longer treated or seen as a real person. I lost my mother, and now I watch my wife falling victim to the same powerful forces. Now, I understand that both the Queen and the Prince of Wales have been informed of this legal action. Both the Duke and Duchess clearly feel very strongly about this. They feel that they have no option now but to take one of the country's most powerful newspaper groups to court. In a statement, the Mail on Sunday has said that it stands by its story and that it will be defending this case vigorously.
Nicholas Witchell. Now to the Netherlands and a change of gear. That's the sound of thousands of farmers bringing gridlock to The Hague, blocking roads and parks with hundreds of tractors and causing over 1,000 kilometres of traffic jams. Our correspondent Anna Holligan made it through the traffic to join them.
We're standing in a field in the heart of The Hague, just across from the central station, surrounded by hundreds, if not even possibly thousands of tractors. Tractors as far as the eye can see. You could probably hear them actually rolling all around me. Some of them are blasting music, some are blaring their horns. Thank you. Most are flashing their lights, and all around this field, which is relatively close to the Dutch Parliament, there are police positioned to try to maintain some level of control.
So why are Dutch farmers so angry? The BBC's Gareth Barlow, a former farmer, explains.
To answer that, we need to go back to May. The top Dutch court ruled that the country was violating European emissions rules. So the government released a series of proposals to tackle emissions, notably nitrogen emissions. And they suggested reducing speed limits. They also suggested closing inefficient cattle farms. They were blaming intensive agriculture on high levels of nitrogen emissions. One Liberal MP even went further. They suggested halving the number of livestock in the country. Agriculture is huge in the Netherlands. That would mean there would be 6 million fewer pigs, 50 million fewer chickens. Now, farmers are very angry at these proposals. They say they're being used as scapegoats, that there's too much attention being put onto them. There should be more focus on aviation, for example. And so, over 2,000 farmers took their tractors into the streets and parks of The Hague, as we heard there from Anna Holligan, and they caused over 1,000 kilometres of gridlock, the worst day on the roads in history.
The BBC's Gareth Barlow. It appears that Russians, who have a reputation as a nation of hard drinkers, are reversing that trend. A study by the World Health Organization shows there was a 43% drop in alcohol consumption per capita in Russia between 2003 and 2016. But Vitaly Shevchenko, Russia editor for BBC Monitoring, told me the picture is extremely complicated.
Statistics isn't always a precise science in Russia and should sometimes be taken with a pinch of salt. Of course, the government often has an interest in massaging the figures, but in Russia's case, one study has shown that a third of the market is made up of alcohol made illegally and sold illegally. So it's really difficult to account for that part of the Russian market. Because so many Russians cannot afford legal spirits, they've started making their own alcohol. They've started drinking things like cask cream wash. They've been consuming medicines based on alcohol, like hawthorn infusions. And as a result, thousands of Russians die of alcohol poisoning each year, and many more get crippled. Many people go blind because they consume illegal alcohol, counterfeit alcohol.
So the figures that they've got, as in alcohol sales, are probably accurate. But what you're saying is that doesn't necessarily feed through to people drinking less. They are still drinking. They're just drinking stuff that's really bad for them.
Absolutely. Alcohol consumption has been a major problem for the Russian government because Russia's population is shrinking. And President Putin has used every major speech he made over the past few years to stress that he's determined to reverse that trend. To make this happen, they've introduced various measures such as banning the sale of alcohol after 11 o'clock in the evening. They've set minimum vodka prices, I think, £2, the equivalent of £2.50 per half a litre. On the face of it, progress has been made. Lots of people are more aware of the need to be fit and the need to exercise. You see joggers, which is something you didn't see, say, 10 years ago.
Vitaly Shevchenko there from BBC Monitoring. Museum officials in Cairo have welcomed the return of the golden coffin of a priest in ancient Egypt, which had been stolen and smuggled out of the country. The gilded sarcophagus was made for a high priest more than 2,000 years ago, Alan Johnson reports.
The golden coffin is a magnificent, highly decorated, gleaming thing that once held the body of a high priest. This ancient treasure was stolen from the province of Minya, south of Cairo, in 2011. But it resurfaced in an exhibition at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. The Met discovered it had been given fake documentation before it bought the coffin. The famous museum has apologised. It was tricked into becoming an unwitting participant in the illegal international trade in antiquities.
Alan Johnson with that report. Finally, the legendary Jamaican singer-songwriter Bob Marley was honoured with an English Heritage Blue Plaque on Tuesday. The plaques are used to mark houses or buildings where famous people have lived or worked. The plaque is fixed outside number 42 Oakley Street in upmarket Chelsea, where the singer and some of his Wailer bandmates lived in 1977. It's there he finished recording his album Exodus and where he pens some of his most famous songs, including Jamming, One Love and Three Little Birds. So we sent Emma Jane Kirby out into the pouring rain to watch the plaque being unveiled.
You don't really look at 42 Oakley Street, a swish Georgian townhouse in a very swanky part of town with an olive green front door and geranium filled window boxes, and immediately think of the King of Reggae. But in 1977, this property, a little rougher around the edges perhaps, was rented out as a series of rooms, and Bob Marley and his Wailers were the tenants here. And at a rain-drenched ceremony, accompanied by a stoical school steel band, the proof of the great man's residence here is being officially stamped into history as English Heritage award Bob Marley the Blue Plaque of Fame. To poet Benjamin Zephaniah, it's come not a moment too soon.
I've been a fan of Bob Marley since I was a kid because it wasn't just the music. For me as a little young poet, I loved his words. And I think the great thing about Bob Marley's work is that you can take the words away and they still stand alone as poems almost. So I was a great lover of the message that he had, as well as the music, of course. He's not one of the greatest black songwriters or one of the greatest reggae songwriters, one of the greatest songwriters of all time. If it was just a black thing, we'd be in Brixton or something like that, you know. But it's because he means so much to the world and he's such an inspiration to people.
But proving his physical link to 42 Oakley Street has taken years of painstaking research. There is one written record of Bob Marley's address in London. It's the one he gave the London courts when he was busted for drugs in March 1977. Unfortunately, perhaps because he was trying to prevent Oakley Street being searched, he offered a different London address. But oral evidence suggests journalists and his contemporaries remember only meeting Bob Marley at 42 Oakley Street. Among them, the then budding poet Benjamin Zephaniah.
When I was a kid, I sent him a bunch of my poems and asked him, said to him, what do you think? And he actually wrote back a little handwritten note saying, you know, something like, Britain needs you, carry on, young man. And then later on, I actually had the pleasure of meeting him. I think right where we're standing now, he really remembered my poetry and it meant something to him. And of course, that meant something to me.
This plaque to the great Robert Lester Marley is now officially unveiled.
That report from Emma Jane Kirby outside a former home of the legendary Jamaican singer-songwriter Bob Marley. And that is all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can. Just send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Claire McDonnell, and until next time, goodbye.